Bruce, I hear that you're kind of putting the various emergencies that you might run into kind of into two buckets. One is the sort of things that are just going to be a problem on any IFR departure, and you just accept that risk. Things like an engine failure right after takeoff. It's a problem no matter what. And the other bucket that you're putting emergencies into are the things that you can handle and you can mitigate with a good plan, like loading the approach at Salinas and being ready to use it. But I see that there's sort of a middle ground between those two buckets here, where you might have an emergency like, say, a really rough running engine where, you know, you certainly don't want to go out over the water. You may feel like it's unlikely that you'll make it to Salinas, but you've got Watsonville right behind you. Do you try to switch to that approach, swing it around, get on the ground at Watsonville and save the day?
Well, in this airplane, I've got synthetic vision and a G1000. So I might, this is a real emergency. You know, I really don't think I'm going to make it to my planned takeoff alternate. I might very well decide I'm just going to use that synthetic vision and get me back on the ground on the runway I just left, even though it's below minimums. And that would sort of be my consideration, I think, on any night, you know, non-visual takeoff in a single, if I have an airplane that's equipped like this.
Yeah, so I hear might, and I know that part of the reason for having this takeoff alternate is to take the might out of the picture, right? I have a plan. This is what I'm going to do. I'm primed to do it. Would you also brief that? Like, you know, I have Watsonville as a return option too. I have synthetic vision, kind of like, you know, on any takeoff, if I have an engine failure prior to this, if I have an engine failure after this.
Yeah, it's sort of like the impossible turn debate we have exactly. Endlessly, right? And I think I alluded to that in my discussion that, you know, if you have an engine or a serious engine problem right after takeoff, you're going to do whatever it takes if Watsonville is really your only reasonable choice. But yeah, you would have to have that in the back of your mind.
Tom.
Yeah, so just a question. So in thinking about that with synthetic vision, what would you do? I mean, what would your procedure be if shortly after takeoff, engine coughs and quits or something like that?
Yeah, I don't have an approach loaded into Watsonville,
right.
But so, I've got the picture. So yeah. I would have an idea. I mean, we're not dealing with howling winds or anything.
Yeah.
If this happened at a, you know, reasonably low altitude that I could just, you know, turn around. Right. I know I've got enough altitude to turn around. I'm going to see a runway cartoon. I'm going to aim for that. We're talking real emergency here.
Yeah.
Also, at Watsonville, you've got lots of big open fields around. I mean, you could land in the artichoke field at your 1 o'clock. So, yeah. You know, a turn back is less necessary in a pinch there than it might be over a built-up urban area.
Yeah, but that would, again, get back to take a look around for a moment before you take off. Where would I go if something happens below, you know, whatever the altitude is you choose? Which way am I going?
JP.
And it may sound like a little bit of overkill, but one of the things I do when I go into airports, or I know I'm going to be operating in an airport that I'm not that familiar with in a single engine piston, I will actually go on Google Maps, look at the airport and look at everything around it and see where fields are and things like that. So I do have, I've already got in my head, here's my plan. If we have an engine failure, here's where we're going to go. Instead of trying to, when you got a million things going on, trying to figure that out and kind of almost brief that before you take the runway. So when that surprise happens, you're not quite as surprised.
That's a great idea. Yeah, none of this stuff shows up on the IFR low and route chart, the fields below you. Mark?
There's also a function we talk often about people not really understanding their units. There's a function that I see very little use, and that's the flight plan catalog. And the possibility is to load the Watsonville approach into the catalog so that it's there and handy with two or three button pushes to come up right up on the screen.
Dave.
And also, I think we've just got to be honest with ourselves as pilots that there are certain phases of flight in which we don't have a good answer for what we're going to do. We're going to have more exposure on a takeoff into low IMC than we would on a clear, sunny day. You just have to be realistic about the situation you're facing. Ask yourself whether that's an acceptable risk or not. Bruce has decided on this one that it is an acceptable risk, and I wouldn't quibble with that. I mean, he's about 2 minutes from VMC, you know, from being on top of the clouds. But as long as we're realistic, say we don't have an answer for everything, we may not have a turn back option, we may not have a really great place to land as soon as we, you know, if we have a catastrophic engine failure on takeoff. But if we're realistic about what are the chances of these horrible things happening, they're relatively low.
Yeah, there is you can over-prepare, right? There is a point where you can prepare too far in advance to the point that it distracts you from the task at hand, right? I mean, there's a reason that the saying is think of the next thing and the thing after that and not the six things after that. Tom?
Yeah, so that Dave's point about amount of exposure, the same thing is true over the water, right? The airplane doesn't know that it's over water. Out to Gar Lake, okay, that is a little far off the coast. I'm not sure I'd want to go there. My first request to ATC would be, requesting a turn back overland or, a left turn or whatever it takes to get back closer to shore. But again, sometimes you have to accept these risks, and this is the reality of what it is that we do. And if you're not comfortable with it, then fine. But you're going to probably find yourself staying on the ground lots of days.
JP?
My question is, and it's for anybody here at the round table, anybody flying a piston single, what are your personal minimums? These are low ceilings. You don't have an approach to get back in there. You do have some fields around. I've kind of set my threshold, and it really goes into, am I flying a turbine airplane or a piston or what's the equipment I'm flying? Certainly this one is a well-equipped airplane. It's got lots of redundancy with everything except the engine. So where's that threshold? My threshold, really, I feel in a piston single's 500 feet. Different when I'm in a jet or a turboprop, but in a piston single, I've kind of set that, and I live by that. It keeps me on the ground some when maybe I could easily get out, but does anybody else have anything that they set as like, I'm just not going to do it?
Bruce? I'm a little less inclined to set a hard number because, as I said in this setup, in this airplane, with this weather, with this equipment, I can accept this takeoff. If it were really 0-0, no visibility, I'm not going. But in another airplane, I just flew a sim the other day, Cessna 172, but it was round dials, right? Mm-hmm. And it was a bit of a struggle because I'm not used to that anymore, right? So if I were taking off in an older 172 with just mechanical gyros and no synthetic vision and so forth, I wouldn't go with a 200-foot ceiling. That's an important point to make with pilots, especially when we're teaching them. We want to set personal minimums, but you know what I might do in my Bonanza that I'm really familiar with across like the crosswinds we've been fighting or whatever, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do that in another airplane I'm maybe not familiar with, or tailwheel airplane. Yeah. So you have to be a little more subtle in your thinking sometimes while not talking yourself out of the whole concept of personal minimums.
So Bruce, what would it take in that steam gauge 172 to get you to depart here?
Yeah, I'd probably want circling minimums. So that if I did have a problem after takeoff, just so I don't get disoriented, I know I could just drop back down if I went into the clouds and basically enter a pattern and land.
Yeah, I was talking to Wally Moran about this the other day, and he said he has a minimum for every takeoff. I think it was 603.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that then you could get back and you could do something visually in the absolute right. worst case scenario.
Right.
John?
So I want to go back to what Tom was talking about with the overwater. As pilots, we're kind of funny about that. We're terrified of flying over water, single engine pistons and stuff like that. But if you look at the reality of it in this, for one, if you take that Gar Lake departure, you're probably not very far over water before you're going to get a turn back. But if you look at the approach into Watsonville, the Localizer 2 approach is entirely over water. So how did you get there yesterday? You flew 10 or 15 miles over. You flew much farther out over water to do the approach in, if that was the approach you did. Monterey is the same way. The approach is almost entirely over water. So, if you live at a coastal airport, you're going to be flying over water.
And the real point, I think, is one that, I sort of alluded to, but then Dave, mentioned. We do lots of takeoffs where people don't, you're in SoCal. You take off from some of these, there's no place to go, Or, another airport I fly out of regularly, you're basically out over the trees and rocks. There's really no great suitable emergency landing sites. And we don't often, we get obsessed with water when there's often even more serious threats or equally serious threats in other situations.
Any built up city area, it's far worse.
Yeah. I mean, think of Sully. He landed in the river rather than going into
apartment buildings.
Yeah, exactly.
So those of you that are going to take off here, and everybody who is going to use Salinas as the return option. Is that because Salinas is the best option, or is it the only option for you, right? If Salinas didn't exist, are you still going to depart Watsonville?
I don't think any of the other options are better than Salinas. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, the same thing is that we're mitigating, not necessarily eliminating all risk. And really, the other ones, you know, more over water, lower ceilings. This is really the only good option of those that we have.
John.
To go back to your initial question about the two buckets, I think, there's two possible things that could go wrong here. One is the engine quits. You're going in the water. You're landing somewhere. The other is you have a problem where the airplane is still flying, but you got to get back on the ground. And you could then make the 20 or 30 miles over to Salinas, and it's probably the best scenario. So in that first bucket, you're pretty much screwed. You're not getting back anywhere. So I think it's a reasonable risk. You know, we as we said, we take that risk pretty much every time we take off in a piston single.
Yeah, and back to what JP was saying about having a real specific objective criteria for when you take off or not. I think, you know, we talk about, I want to be able to get back on the ground after takeoff, right? Usually that's the departure airport, but it can be another airport nearby. But usually we don't quantify it any more specifically than that. Like, does it have to be that you could get on the ground at that airport just as soon as you could at the departure airport? Or is there, you know, where do you draw the line on that? Is it an airport within 20 miles, 30 miles?
I think one of the advantages of Salinas is that it's in the direction you're going anyway. So you're not dealing with a potential emergency in the clouds and trying to make a 180-degree turn at the same time. So it has that advantage as well, of just being right in line of what you're doing.
And if you think about what are the most likely emergencies, you know, the catastrophic engine failure and an attempted runway turnback are pretty slim. You know, if you lost a cylinder, if you had a rough running engine, if your oil pressure wasn't what you wanted, then it's like you can probably make it 20 miles. I think that in the direction you're already headed. At our home airport where Tom and I fly, it's often foggy. You know, we have morning fog particularly in the fall. But we usually have often have, you know, really good VMC, one valley to the west. And to me, I'll often take off on a foggy morning at our home airport where the visibility is less than the return minimums, but knowing that there's good options nearby.
This is a non-towered airport. As I don't know if you'd be able to reach NorCal approach from the ground or not over the radio, but the chart supplement says to get your clearance over the phone. So that's what this pilot has done. John, can you kind of tell us who are they talking to? Is it the controller that's actually going to be controlling them? What's the kind of coordination that goes on behind the scenes in this
More
case?
Than likely, what the situation, what's happening here is the each area within the approach control would have a flight data position. And that's the position that actually gets the strips off the printer, does the clearances and things. So that would be the person answering the phone. And then they would read the clearance, and then they would go over to the appropriate radar controller who's running that sector, say, I've got a release off Watsonville on the Garlic, and coordinate it. Somehow they would work it out. The radar controller might say, okay, you know, give them a 5-minute window in 5 minutes from now, something like that, and I'll make a hole. Or forget it, tell them to call back in 20 minutes, whatever. But they're going to coordinate that, and then that flight data controller is going to come back and read you the release or the departure instructions or whatever. So in most cases, in a busy facility like this, you're probably not actually talking to the radar controller. In a less busy facility where positions are combined, you may actually be talking. But either way, they have to do basically a non-radar block. They're going to block 2,000 feet within some radius of that airport and work out a hole in the arrivals into Monterey or whatever they've got to do to coordinate that.
My follow-up question to that is, I talked a little about maybe trying to ask, you know, let the controller know, hey, I really don't want to go far out over the water.
Yeah.
So could that request be relayed from the data to the controller?
Yep.
I mean, I understand in the real world, as soon as they get you in radar contact, traffic permitting, they're going to turn you en route. But but you could make that request with them, right?
I've had that situation coming out of Myrtle Beach. We were heading back home to the Raleigh area from Myrtle Beach, and there were thunderstorms coming into the area. And when I picked up my clearance, I saw it was going to send us right into the thunderstorms. And I said, could you relay to the radar controller that we'd like to stay clear of those thunderstorms? He said, not going to be a problem, and gave me headings right away.
Yeah.
And you got to think that these controllers get that request from single engine pilots all the time. And if you were right about the tops, that you're in clear air at a relatively low altitude, you know, and you were getting sent further out over the water than you were willing to accept, then you can cancel IFR, VFR on top, and back to the coastline.
That's a great point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. You could certainly do that. So if you were to, say, try to wait for a gap so you didn't have to fly the Garlic, Sid, the coordination becomes a little bit of a problem because you can't...
You would never know when the gap is coming.
Right.
Because you're not talking to the controller. It's not like you're actually in radio contact with the approach controller. So it might be call back in 20 minutes or, you know, some time frame like that where the controller could get a heads up, okay, I got to get this guy out of here. Sooner or later, I got to make a hole in the arrivals rather than actually waiting for a gap in the stream, because right. You're never going to know when it goes by.
Right. Whereas if you were at a location where you'd be able to reach the
like a towered airport, something like that, where they could make a gap in the final to accommodate your departure. But in this case, just strictly talking by phone, it's a one-way conversation.
Just a quick question for the roundtable. Do you find it easier to fly over water in IMC or above the clouds than on a clear day? Psychologically, just purely, purely psychologically.
I think so. Yeah, it's totally meaningless psychologically. I remember going down to Key West, and we were kind of departing the Naples area and over water, but we were 7,000 feet, and there was a cloud layer beneath us, and we're just cruising along. Had I been down there looking at the ocean, I would be like, oh man, we're over water. So yeah, I think so. It's kind of weird, but I agree.
I just it reminded me of a situation. I took off from Venice, Florida one night in a 172, and it was a dark night, but beautiful VMC. And shortly after takeoff, got out over the water, and immediately realized that how difficult it was to maintain any kind of a situational awareness without going right to the instruments and really treating it as if you're flying in IMC. I'd almost rather be in IMC because mentally I'm prepared to be on the instruments over the water as opposed to taking off in a situation where you're thinking it's VFR and in fact it might as well be IMC.
Right.
I think you're also, when you're in IMC, you have a job to do.
Right.
And that takes away from consideration of other things going on around you.
We had last summer with the wildfires, even in Wisconsin, we had a lot of days where it was like 4 miles and clear, and you get up to 6,000 feet or something, and you may as well be an IMC, but it's clear. You know,
yeah.
It doesn't feel like it should take any work to be flying on a clear day. You know, let's say in this situation, Watsonville's even lower, a little better than 0-0. All right, but there's an airport right next door that's clear, so that's not an issue, right? You've got somewhere to go immediately after takeoff if you need it. I know, JP, do you still want 500-foot ceilings in that case at the departure airport? Are you comfortable with the actual act of taking off in the 0-0?
I had a very similar experience, what you're just talking about. It was almost 0-0 in Ocala, Florida, and all of the surrounding airports, everything, in fact, right across the street from the airport, it was in the clear. It had just set up right there over the field. And I elected to go ahead and take off. I knew, number one, I'm going to break out of it very quickly. And then everything geographically around the airport was in the clear. So that left me with a lot of options, even though technically that ASOS station, that ceiling, is probably, you know, 50-foot overcast if you got right down to it.
Bruce? Well, here's the issue in my mind is how confident are you, how proficient are you in managing that initial, you know, takeoff and climb out? Don't care what kind of equipment you've got, what the weather nearby is. If you haven't practiced this, if you aren't really comfortable with your basic attitude instrument flying skills, then that's going to adjust what your minimums are, I think, or should adjust those minimums for you.
Yeah, yeah. There are two things that could make a takeoff dangerous, right? One is just there's no emergency return option.
Right.
And then you're just playing the odds. The other is it's actually so low that the actual takeoff is difficult, right? And I know some instructors teach instrument takeoffs. Any of you guys do that with students?
Yeah. I don't know how realistic they are, really. You know, sitting on the runway with just watching the DG and steering.
Yeah.
It's not that same effect as losing all visual reference at 50 feet and trying to clean up the airplane if it's retractable, retrimming, you know, retracting the takeoff flaps and doing all that. There's real world, and then there's what we do under the hood.
Mark?
I think one of the underlying issues is that, you know, as we've already talked about, there is no requirement that we abide by takeoff minimums. There's also no requirement that we abide by ODPs unless they're actually assigned by ATC. That doesn't necessarily make it a good idea. And I think that's where a lot of people's personal minimums come in, that, you know, I am not going to take off in 00. I am not going to take off when the ceiling is only enough to let me get back in.
Dave.
Just to your question about teaching the 00 takeoff, the value that I find in doing that is not so much that anybody's ever going to do a 00 takeoff, but it's a really good opportunity to feel the vertigo and the illusion that comes with acceleration and a pitch up. So it's like I find it helpful, and a helpful experience for someone new to the IFR, but not necessarily for the reason given.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point, because it's you're trying to solve that problem of people taking off, entering IMC, and accidentally leveling off at 300 feet, right? Just flying along level because they feel the acceleration and it feels like a pitch up, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
This whole situation reminded me of a discussion about taking off in, you know, really low conditions. Reminds me of that Florida crash. I think it was Cessna 310 a couple of years ago on Christmas Eve. Took off with a family of, I think there were like four on board. It was so foggy that the fellow had the airplane tugged out to the ramp because he wasn't even comfortable taxiing. The conditions were so low, but managed to get to the runway, took off. I don't even think they cleared the end of the runway or the airport property before he lost the airplane, and they crashed and they all died. And so what a horrible crash that was with this guy taken off and clearly not, you know, we don't know, for sure whether he had any instrument problems. Could be there was an instrument failure, but clearly he wasn't prepared to deal with the situation taking off in a day that was that low.
Tom, I was thinking about that same crash that was in Florida, in Bartow, Florida. I had just been at that airport the day before that happened, and that area is so fog prone you couldn't see anything during the early morning. And it's one of those situations on that particular day, had that pilot waited another hour and a half, it would have been a beautiful day, and that's all it took. You know, if you're having to get assistance with somebody to tow you to where you need to be, it's probably a day you don't need to be flying.
Yeah, I remember looking at the weather, hearing about that crash, looking at the weather reports, and then seeing the photographs of the accident were taken, you know, whatever, minutes later. Mm-hmm. Or short time later, and it's clear skies.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful day. If he had just waited a little bit, it would have made all the difference.
That's a good point, too, because we've talked a lot about, you know, engine failures and other failures, electrical failures, but really a big risk in this is loss of control.
Yeah.
At takeoff or initial climb. And so that needs to be in the mix as well.
So, Mark, you know, you said this is all a legal departure. There's nothing illegal about this, right? And that's totally true. There's nothing that's obviously wrong about this at first glance. It's an IFR day. You're in a well-equipped IFR airplane. You take off. You climb through the clouds. It's a nice flight on top the rest of the way. Decent weather at your destination. And it really all comes down to what your risk tolerance is, whether you're okay with the potential for something going wrong and what you do in that case or what you won't be able to do in that case. And that's fine. I mean, everybody's going to have a different opinion on this departure. But you really have to be able to at least quantify the risks in order to make an informed decision